Accession number 18463, reel 15.
I ran down the road to them, and there coming down the road was a little short Chinese chap in a sort of a uniform, and he's got a pig on a straw lead, and he got within about, I guess, 100 yards of us, and I'm saying to the lads, we're going to take our first prisoner, this is fantastic, we've never had a prisoner before like this, well, not a Chinese one, we had plenty of Koreans, we hadn't had a Chinese fella, and just at that moment, a chap ran out. A chap named Clark, actually, ran out from D Company and collared him, so we lost our prisoner. And he was waving his safe conduct pass, and he got this pig, so I guess he sort of come along with his rations. And he was dressed in, obviously, a military uniform with a little cap, like a schoolboy's cap. But it was all absolutely worn. I've never seen anything so worn in all my life. He looked 100 years old. And they took him off to the rear, and in fact there are some photographs, funny enough, of him and Clark, but not of the pig, funny enough. You can see the straw lead, but you can't see the pig in the photograph. And that was the last we saw of him. Shortly after this, we start to move back. D Company's in the lead this time, and I think we must have been behind D Company. Possibly, yes, we were behind D Company. They're in the lead and on the tanks. I think we were in the trucks, reasonably confident we were in the trucks. We came up, back up, and it was all we expected, of course, to have to fight for our positions of the day before, or rather our rear positions of the day before, not the ones that we'd attacked and had to withdraw from. And we had some tanks with us this time, about four or five tanks, Pattons, and we eventually got up to the positions where we were. D Company by this time had gone off to the right, back to the hill that they'd been on the previous day, which is quite a pointed little hill overlooking the road. B Company went off, two platoons went off to the left, up onto a little low ridge with some MMGs. Company headquarters in the few houses that were there, and 6th platoon, we were set off out in the paddy. And it was frozen solid. It had been ploughed. And, of course, the plough, it goes deeper and deeper, the frost, you just can't dig in at all. So all we could do was, somebody had got an axe, Nicky, I think it was, had found an axe somewhere or other, and we knocked off great lumps of clods and just piled them up there. But we just couldn't get down at all. It was absolutely no good at all. We knew that we were the counter-attack platoon, so we thought, well, you know, we'll just shelter what best we can, because the moment something happens, we'll be moved to somewhere else. And there was a Nissen hut, big black Nissen hut there. I went over there to see if I'd get some wood for a fire, and when I went inside, there was a sleeping bag in there, a bloody sleeping bag, all torn and a feather one of the best ones, and a pair of boots, a pair of shoe pack boots, which the Australians had changed into on the 6th of November. We didn't, they did. And I took the boots. Sleeping bag was no good, it was blood covered and what have you. So I did wonder whether that was anything to do with the poor old driver of the lorry, which was still there. But I've no idea if it was or it wasn't. Came back, and just at that moment, up on the embankment where the railway line was, went through below it, somebody said there's somebody up there, and we all stood too, and we could see what looked like somebody poking their head up and then popping back down again, poking their head up and popping their back down again. And it was peculiar, because it was a sort of a rhythm in it. And slowly we recognised, through the field glasses, I could see that it was a woman. And she was crawling over this embankment and sort of bobbing up and down. And she literally rolled down the embankment into the paddy and started to very slowly crawl towards us. And Nick and Wardy said, let's go out and get her in. And I went back to the platoon sergeant, to the platoon commander, Albert, who was a sergeant, and said, look, there's a woman out there. Can we go out and get her in? He said, no, you can't. You mustn't leave your position. So I went back and said, well, we can't go. He won't let us go. And they said, well, don't care. Going anyway. So I said, well, if you're going, I'm going. So I went back to Albert and said, well, it's no good. We're determined to go. And the lads won't take no for an answer. He said, well, all right, then, go out there. And we went out there loaded with all their equipment. And she got about, I guess, 50 yards from the embankment by the time we arrived at her. She laid, once she saw us coming, she laid there. And poor girl, she was dressed in summer clothes, and she was in a terrible state. Her ankles were blue, and in fact, we found out later that they were smashed. And I didn't really know what to do for her, so I said to one of the lads, well, go back and get a stretcher, and we'll carry her back. And I was kneeling down beside her and trying to sort of console her, saying that, you know, she didn't understand what we were saying. But her trousers, which were like pyjama trousers, had pulled down over her stomach sort of thing, so she got a lump of bare stomach there. And I went to reach forward to pull them up for her, you know, just to sort of make her a bit more decent. And she screamed and yelled, and Nikki said to me, she thinks you're going to rape her. So we sort of stood back from her then and just squatted down around her. Albert came back then. He hadn't got the stretcher, but he got two civilians, an elderly lady and a gentleman. And the gentleman got her up on his back and carried her away. And Nicky went off with them. And he said they laid her in a bed in one of the houses up there. And she grabbed hold of his hand and kissed his hand and thanked him. And the old chap, through her interpreter, had told the story was that night, which was more or less the night that we had passed through. We'd been doing our attack, rather, not the night we passed through, not the attack. The Chinese had come in after we'd left, and they found her. She had a baby at that time, and they'd raped her and then smashed her ankles with the butts of their rifles or guns and left her there, and she'd had to crawl out and leave the baby, and the baby was up there. So one of the chaps, a chap we called Padge and Wardy, said they'd try and get up and find the baby. They didn't know where to look. I mean, it was in a house somewhere or other. Anyway, they got about 200 yards up there, and the fire was so heavy they couldn't, and they didn't know where to go, so they came back. So unfortunately, we couldn't get the baby, but at least we got the mum out, although I can't think what happened to her later. Anyway, this is the second day, and about midday, the fire from up the pass is getting heavy, or the aircraft mainly that we're hearing is getting fairly heavy, and the aircraft across to our front, which is to the west in actual fact, although in your mind everywhere's, whichever way you look at it, is always north, but it was in fact the west. There's a road there which we thought led up to Anjou. In fact it didn't. I didn't know this to 40 years later. And the aircraft are going along, they're getting farther and farther along this road, so it's obvious that they're beating away along there. And we get some guns arrive then. I think it's probably about 11 o'clock when the guns fire. And they fired their first shot. And it was pretty typical of the gunners. The first shot hit right spot on the pinnacle of D Company's hill. And we saw the diggers all jump for cover and then get up and look around again, and they hadn't been hit. Well, that was pretty par for the course. Unfortunately, of course, they can't fire because they don't know where 2nd Div is, so they didn't do a great deal of firing. Our mortars are firing over our heads into the valley. And about, I guess it was about midday, somebody called me forward and said, there's transport coming down the road there from the 2nd Div area. And looking through the field glasses, we could see all sorts of vehicles coming through. And hardly any of the troops were armed. And they were hatless. And it was obvious they were dead, wounded, goodness knows what. Tanks were coming through, covered in bodies and jeeps, trailers there with the, you know, just obviously either dead or wounded men all over them. We couldn't believe it. it's a long story, but basically, instead of doing what they should have done, fight their way down through there, which everybody thought they would have done. That's what we've been expecting them to fight their way through. They just tried to run the gauntlet and they'd been decimated. Terrible casualties. We heard later that they'd had about 400 killed in the past and about 3,000 casualties all told, of which, of course, a lot of those are captured. And we couldn't believe this because they were just... Well, they were... I'll be honest, they were a mob. Poor people. They just had a terrible time. So many casualties they had. Tanks covered in them. This went on then for a while, and things were getting just a little bit hectic now. And we were called back up to the road to guard air. We had a truck for each, we had three trucks, a truck for each platoon. And so we got to get about, 30-odd guys into each truck. Because in actual fact, of course, the cooks and the queue staff and all that, they hadn't come up with us. It was only the teeth elements that had come up with us. The rest of the company had stayed back behind with main battalion HQ. And we had to place a guard on the trucks because they had coloured drivers, and there was some concern that they might they might clear off, to be quite honest. But though we like to say that we put it on to stop them being commandeered, but the main worry was that they might suddenly start up and clear off and leave us there. Anyway, they were on the road, and shortly after this, we saw a civilian come out, and we thought, oh, he's going off to report, but he was out of view before we could do anything about it. And then an American came down with a wounded guy, and we helped him, got the wounded chap onto one of our trucks and left him up there, ready for us to move off. And when we moved off, and he said, I've got another chap back down the road there, could he give me a hand? And I said, hold on, I'll have to ask. So I said to Albert, this chap's got another wounded fellow down the road. Can I go off and help him get him in? And he wouldn't let me. He said, no way. You've had your little journey for the day, your little bit of do-gooding. We're the only people left here with any in a military state, so you cannot go. So I said to the chap, well, I'm sorry, he won't let me go. And I remember it now. He looked me straight in the face. He said, I remember you, Nottingham. And I did feel terrible, but I couldn't go. I couldn't go and help him. But what was more, I couldn't see how he couldn't have helped both of the wounded chaps in, And I had a strange feeling about this American. Suddenly, perhaps it was because he'd upset me, but I just didn't feel that he was... He was genuine. I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was. He was very upset with us. And a few seconds after that, there was MMG fire coming from over the 4-platoon position, going straight over the top, heavy machine gun fire. And he ducked down and got undercover. And I said, don't worry, that's ours, not theirs. He said, I've heard their machine gun fire, he said, for the last 4 days, and I can tell you that is not yours, that's theirs. And I said, oh, no, it's not, no. Actually, I knew it wasn't ours, because I knew where our MNGs were, but I was trying to sort of calm him down. Anyway, he went off back down the road, spitting blood sort of thing, that we wouldn't go and help him. And a few seconds after that, we were told to load up. And I couldn't find anywhere on the trucks. They were jammed solid. So I started to get up on the wing of the truck. The wings of American trucks are very wide, and you can sit on them, in actual fact, if you're forced to. So I got up on there. And then suddenly, from behind, came a shout. And I looked round, and everybody in all the trucks were looking up at the ridge, which 4 and 5 platoon had just come down from. And apparently, they'd seen heads along the top there, suddenly bobbing up. And it was obviously the Chinese had arrived. And they were covering them. And before anything could happen, three tanks came bursting down the pass. I thought they were T-34s, actually, because I could only see the top turret part of them, firing at anything and everything, all over the place. Turrets closed down, shooting away there like mad. And we leapt out the trucks because it was flying between the trucks, over the tops of our heads, and there was some high tension wires there. It cut one of these and it came swinging down into the, not into us actually, but into the paddy beside of us. And they were really going mad. And suddenly it all stopped, and we didn't know why. In actual fact, the CO had got out, armed with his stick, and with Macmillan, CSM Macmillan. They got out there and stopped them. They were American tanks who were, had just come into us. But unfortunately, because they'd shot a few people up in the meantime, they killed one of the MMGs and shot another one through the bum, and maybe others, I don't know. But they stopped them, and the CO apparently explained to them that if they didn't stop shooting his men, he was going to tell his CSM to shoot the driver or shoot the commander or what have you. And they went on their way, and leaving us, you know, there with no support. Shortly after this, the column moved off. I'm up on the wing of the truck now, and we start to go down. First of all, past the road junction, and coming down, there's a very thin dribble of the odd jeep and things like that. A lot of them with flat tyres, trailers, and one in particular had a driver, flat tyre, and a chap sitting beside the driver with a carbine, just firing it at random into the air, into the hills. He didn't care what he was shooting at. And the trailer behind, I think they were dead. They were just legs hanging over. The bodies of the people were in the trailer, and the legs were hanging over the trailer side, just booted legs, and you could see them on both sides of the trailer. And we went on a little bit then. Going very slow, the convoy is now. We're being shot at, you know, it's coming all over. And there was a couple of tanks had stayed with us, fortunately, and they were out in the paddy shooting up Chinese, or maybe Korean guerrillas, one doesn't know, who had been poking their heads over the hill there. But very, very little, just odd people coming down the pass. We went on a little bit, and there was a Turkish officer, and he had a fancy hat on, with a tassel on it. I'd not seen a Turkish officer before. A bit like Air Hussars have fancy hats. Very smart chap. And his guard that was with him was terrified. You could see terror in his eyes. And he was at the on guard position, staring out over the road. And the officer was very calm and cool and collected. And I said to him, I waved him, I said, come on, get up with me on the wing of the truck. And he said, no, 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 you know. And I looked the way they were looking, and coming down the slope, a very steep slope, and across the railway line, were loads and loads of people who I think he thought were Turks. I don't know who they were. They may have been Turks, they may have been Chinese, they could have been anybody, rocks. And as we drove slowly on past him, the road on the left-hand side was hundreds of rocks, going along, marching along, heads down, well equipped. And the most peculiar thing was they'd obviously found a stores where the brand new American overcoat, raincoats, and they'd obviously broken into it, because they arrive with a pink label on every little bit, hundreds of pink labels, every section, pockets, lips, every little bit has got a little pink label. And there are these chaps marching down the road in these raincoats, and they weren't taking the labels off, they had all these pink labels all over them. It was quite amusing, really, if you could have been amused at that moment of time. A little bit farther on, we came to the gun pits. I don't know how many, four I would guess. Four gun pits, now empty, of course, because the guns are gone. And in fact, we'd seen just prior to this, we'd seen the command vehicle come out from the paddy, and a chap was hanging on the back, sort of spread eagle across, but hanging on whilst it bumped over the paddy. Presumably he was going to get aboard when he got up out of the paddy. Mortar bomb dropped, and just as he got up on the road, mortar bomb dropped, and he fell off, and the lorry went off without him. And in fact, we now passed him, and he was he had a big red patch on his back. And I remember him, he had a mass of black hair, and it was all getting covered in the dust as he lay in the ditch there. And a bit farther on, the gun pits. And the gun pits have been used to accommodate the dead. And they were laid out in a great big cartwheel, heads into the centre. I can't begin to imagine, 30, 40 maybe, because you get people into a gun pit and put them side by side. You get a devil a lot in there. And they just put a blanket over their heads, and we drove past them, then past the American, two Americans who were still there laid on the side of the road. But as we come up that night, that somebody had put a coloured quilt over them, but I noticed the quilt was gone and their boots were gone. And that caused some amusement later on, because they all said I'd had the boots, because I'd got a pair of these boots, you see, in the truck. And of course, we'd never have a dead man's boots. And as we went on past, the people are pouring over the railway embankment, coming towards us. I thought they were either rocks or Turks. Somebody later said they were Chinese. I don't know. They may have been. I don't know. I'm on the front of the truck now. We went on about, I guess, maybe half a mile. One could never tell on these things. And there was the CO standing on the side of the road with his scarf. He used to wear it like a college boy, you know, with it slung around his neck, and his jerkin, and his 38, and his hat, and his stick, of course. Always had his stick. And he's directing the tanks, each tank in the column, he's directed them into field onto the side there, because otherwise they'd have just popped off back to chase, and they wouldn't have stayed around and looked for trouble. And he was back in the mine, and I looked at him, and I had to smile, and I'd like to think he smiled back, but I don't suppose he did. And now the lorry began to pick up speed a bit, and it was cold. My legs began to get frozen, and I could, my hands were freezing as well, and I was trying to grip on, there's a metal grill in front of the headlight, and I'm trying to grip onto this because he's bouncing along a bit. Oh, I picked up, incidentally, I forgot to say, back near the Turkish officer, I'd picked up a rock who wanted a lift, and I'd beckoned him up onto the other wing, and the silly old so-and-so had gone and sat with his back in front of the driver, which had caused a certain amount of confusion. I wasn't very popular with the people in the cab because of that, but I got him onto the wing, and he was hanging onto the other side. We dashed on. It began to get a little bit dark now, and as it got dark, there was a American lorry had gone off the road, about a 1500 weight size, I think they called 3/4 tonners. It run off the side. He was heavily laden, and a load of black lads were waving us down, and I thought the driver would stop. He didn't. He put his foot down and whistled past them, and I'm shouting out to them, there's a tank coming up behind, he'll tow you out. And they're going, shaking their fists at me, sort of thing, you know. I didn't know that the sergeants and officers and what have you in the cab, incidentally, I could have got in the cab, there's plenty of room in the cab, but he wouldn't let me in. They had been told to stop for nothing. They had to get to Chase Anne at all costs. Stop for nothing. Don't pick anybody up. Don't do anything. But I didn't know that. And I've got this guilt complex that we left these poor old black lads on the side of the road shaking their fists at us. And we then went into a wooded area, and I'll be honest, things go pretty dead for me from then on. My legs are dead up to my knees, above my knees. I'm freezing, and we're whistling through the night. Now, my next memory is we stopped in a little village. It's before St. John. You could see it on the map. And there was a line of ambulances ahead of us. And we stopped behind these ambulances. And there's loads of rocks milling about all over the place. And my little lad suddenly saw his unit. And I guess he was a porter. He wasn't a soldier. He jumped off and came round and tried to shake me hand and went off into a hut. I think he was a... You know, pretty good that. I mean, he could have stayed with us and gone farther back, but he saw his unit and he instantly rejoined it for a porter. That's pretty good going. We went on again, following. I presume we followed the ambulances. I didn't really see them. I'm pretty dead by this time with the cold. And my next memory is we turned right at St. John down the road where we'd gone the previous on the 28th. And the next thing I remember is the convoy stopped again, and an Aussie, damn great Aussie, came up to me and said, it's rough up there, mate, is it? And I said, well, you know, I don't know what I did say, really. I agreed with him, and I think we had a little conversation about second div, you know, and how they were committing suicide and what have you, and couldn't understand why the hell they weren't fighting. But that's the sort of thing that goes on when you don't know what's going on in a war or a battle. And we went slowly on. They were, you know, chatting to us. Went slowly on and pulled off the road at Chase Anne into exactly the same place where we'd been on the first night, where we'd had about an hour and a half kip. And everybody got off the truck. And I couldn't move. I was sort of solid. And I thought, well, nobody's going to help me. I mean, they all got their own problems. And they were all going off. I could see a fire. Funny enough, it was one of the old boiler things that we abandoned at Pakchon, and which, funny enough, there's a little story there where Colonel Mann had made them go back and collect them again, or some of them, but this was probably the only one remaining. And I thought, if I can get that fire, I'll thaw out. So I dropped down off the wing of the truck, and my legs gave way underneath me. I couldn't stand up because they were just not operational. I mean, my legs were not operational. And gradually I forced myself up, and I got me, I suppose I had a Sten, I can't remember, I think it was a Sten gun at that time. And I using that as a sort of a crutch, I sort of half crawled and eventually got over to this fire. And once I got stood up by the fire, it was beautiful. It was glowing red, the outside metal. And gradually, my legs came back to life again. I guess it must have taken about 20 minutes or so. And when I could move, I went to see Albert. And he said, well, you can do the last stag of the night, as you seem to be the last one in. I must have got a bit of rest, I guess. I can't really remember. I couldn't have had very long, I don't think. But I got a bit of rest. And I did the stag from about about 3 to 5, something like that. 2 hour stags we were having to do because there was so few of us, the NCOs it is. And I did my, which is just a patrol in stag, you know, just walking about in amongst the sleeping bodies and keeping the sentries, of course, awake, making sure they were doing the same. And eventually I went over to this boiler thing that was going away there. And there were 2 civilians there, and I didn't know who they were at the time. I now know they were, I think his name's Ralph Whitaker, and Churchill's son, Randolph Churchill, the Churchill's son. He had a great big duffel coat on, and a woolly hat, and I think his name's Ralph, isn't it? Ralph Whitaker. He didn't have a hat on. That's only how I really recognise him, because he's slick back hair. And they were chatting to us. And I think we were being fairly rude about the Americans, probably. And the cooks came over. And, of course, cooks who hadn't actually been with us up there were giving them some lurid stories. They'd stayed back where they were now. And they were, I presume, taking it all in. And funny enough, the CO came over and joined us. And we all felt around, did our buttons off just in case. And he was talking to these reporters, but he wasn't saying much. They were trying to draw him out, you know, to be critical, as reporters always do. But he didn't say anything, hardly anything at all, except to say, and I must say, I was a bit overcome with this, to say how pleased with us he was, you know, because we didn't think we'd done too well at all. And he was saying how pleased he was and how well the battalion has done, you know, and what have you. And we just blossomed out a little bit. And shortly after that, we had Stand 2, which again was just a matter of people getting up, putting on their equipment and standing around in their bed space and gradually forming up and, you know, inspections and things like that. And the day went on then. I never saw the reporters anymore. They went off somewhere. They probably went off with the CIO expert. And about midday, the transport on the...